Intervju Radija Študent.
3. maj je po odločitvi Generalne skupščine Združenih narodov razglašen za Svetovni dan svobode medijev. A kaj ta koncept pomeni danes, skoraj 400 let po Miltonovi Areopagitiki, enem od najodmevnejših filozofsko-umetniških delu za govor svobodi izražanja, ko naj bi v demokratičnih državah, vsaj deklarativno, za vselej opravili s cenzuro in ko imajo avtoritarni režimi zaradi razvoja novih komunikacijskih tehnologij vedno več težav pri filtriranju nezaželenih političnih stališč. Kakšen emancipatorni potencial nosijo s seboj te nove tehnologije in kako svobodno do izražanja izkoriščajo državljani demokratičnih držav? Kakšne vrste cenzure danes ogrožajo prost pretok informacij in kateri centri moči jih usmerjajo? O teh in drugih vprašanjih povezanih s svobodo medijev danes smo se pogovarjali z doktorjem Richardom Barbrukom, profesorjem na oddelku za družbene vede, humanistiko in jezike Westminsterske univerze. Barbruk je dober poznavalec medijske problematike, ukvarjal se je z medijsko zakonodajo znotraj Evropske unije in napisal nekaj vplivnih knjig ter člankov z področja medijev in novih komunikacijskih tehnologij. Še predtem, v 80-ih letih, je eksperimentiral s piratskimi in alternativnimi radijskimi postajami in v tem obdobju je obiskal tudi Radio Študent, o katerem še danes ohranja zelo dobro mnenje. Začeli smo torej z vprašanjem, kje Barbruk vidi glavne izzive za svobodo medijev danes.
Well, I think there's the traditional ones. There's political censorship. People want to close down people, who are saying things that are unwelcome. WikiLeaks being the obvious example. But the main thing is economic censorship. I mean, in the sense that what's interesting is in my lifetime, I've gone from, when I was in my 20s, we used to have to climb tower blocks and install pirate radio transmitters to make radio broadcasts. Unlike in socialist Yugoslavia, Thatcher's Britain, they didn't allow dissidents to broadcast on the airways. And we would be chased by the police, and we were closed down, basically, by the police eventually. So there's political censorship, but I said the real thing now is sort of economic censorship, because what's happened in my lifetime is that you can set up a radio station whatever you like. We made a film, Class War Games, presents Guy Debord's Game of War. You make a 25-minute film, you can put it up on Vimeo, it can go out across the world. But the question now is, it's not so much people have got the means of production of this communication, it's actually getting it out there for people to watch. So there's lots and lots of information out there, but it's what Michael Goldfather calls it's the attention economy, is how do you make it from actually having out there to people actually listening to it and that, or watching it, or reading it. And I think that's the interesting thing, that we've got to that stage now, because even though there is a sort of free-for-all, everybody technically can broadcast, the big major media players, the BBCs and the News Corps and all the rest of it, are still in there because that's where people turn to for their news or their entertainment or whatever.
But is this the question of freedom or of advertising, more of advertising?
Well, advertising is a form of economic censorship, and it comes back to this. I mean, if you're willing to put your own free time into making and distributing something, you can. But the difficulty becomes when you want to take it to the next stage, which is to get people paid for doing it or promoting it or things like that. And that does cost money, and it's a circle, isn't it? I mean, either the money comes from the state through the license fee, and that's going to lead to controls, or it's from advertising, or you get people to pay for it. And each of them have problems in restricting what people can consume. And also, as I said, it's this interesting thing. As I said, when we were pirates, it was actually quite difficult to broadcast, but it was very easy for people to listen to it because everybody had a radio which they could receive from. Now, in a way, it's the other way around. It's actually very easy to produce it. It's actually quite difficult to get people to consume it. unless they know about it and want it and go to it. So, you know, if you wanted to know what was happening in, you know, Tahrir Square during the protests last year, you could go onto a website and see it. There were friends of mine uploading mobile phone footage of them in the square. But most people were getting their news from the mainstreams, you know, the Al Jazeera, BBC, places like that. And therefore, they were obviously filtered through those particular ways of looking at the world.
Some recent events may also suggest that power and influence of some media is too big, or let's say even excessive.
You mean Rupert Murdoch?
Yes, for example, yeah.
Well, 25 years ago, I was outside his printing plant in Wapping, because one of my members of my local Labour Party was a printer who was fired by him. And I was there when the police attacked the crowd. And I've had two near-death experiences in my life, one in a car crash, and the other was running away from the Metropolitan Police who were trying to club us on the head. It's amazing they didn't kill anybody that day, but Thatcher sent in the police to basically prop up Rupert Murdoch, and that's where this unhealthily close relationship between the politician, the police and the media started, breaking the unions and propagandizing for neoliberalism. So in that way, you can see that he's, you know, in a sense, he's a politician who owns, an unelected politician who owns lots of media, and he was, you know, pursuing a very definite political agenda, both here and in America.
Does this case maybe point us to the need for curbing this excessive media?
Well, that's the question. You see, the question then is, you know, it's the question about state regulation. You know, do you think that the state has a positive role to play in a democratic society, that it can go in there and, you know, provide public service broadcasting, subsidies to student radio, regulate against excessive monopolies, or is it actually a threat to? Because once you give the state that power, obviously it will start to censor what's broadcast. I mean, you know, the BBC in this country, I mean, its coverage of the economic crisis the last 4 years has been abysmal, and partly that's because of, you know, who it represents. I mean, it's not going to go against too much the City of London's interest, because they're the ones who control the political parties. So you get bankers on being asked continuously about their solutions to the economic crisis, but very few trade unionists or Greens or lefties. So that's the question, you know, do you trust the state to regulate these things?
When you speak about media and politics today, the word trivialization also often comes in front. Majority of mainstream media today is profit-oriented, as you said, and these features drive them to contents of infotainment and show.
Yeah. And public service broadcasting as well, because they need to maximize their audiences to justify the money they're getting from the license fee.
In this context, I would like to ask you on which side of the argument you stand, that which says that the media only reflects popular tastes and preferences, or the other which claims that it is creating them?
Both, I would think. It's a dialectic between the two, isn't it? You know, there obviously is an amazing appetite for humans for gossip and trivia. I mean, you don't just look at the sort of Twitter feeds or, you know, or emails or Facebook. The amount of people, you even take it away from celebrity culture. If you look at, say, Facebook and the number of pictures of cats on there, or on YouTube, my children doing funny things. So it's not even celebrity culture, it's just general culture. So you can say that you can create a free media where everybody can say what they like, but whether they will say, they will use this in a political sense, in the sense, you know, originally in the 17th and 18th and 19th and 20th century, people said, well, you give people free media, and the reason is because they want, is to make them into citizens. So they will go there and they will use the media both to get the information and also to send out their own opinions into the world, which will then allow them as a collective group of people to make the choices about how their society develops. And that's only one thing that people actually use the media for. They probably put up far more pictures of cats than they do of politicians.
Did I sense some kind of disillusionment?
No, not at all. I think that's just being realistic. I mean, the question is if you have two-way communications and then you do have a crisis in your society or political things going on, then it allows people to mobilise a lot quicker. We've seen this in the last few years around all these anti, you know, the, all the, you know, first the alter globalization protests in around the turn of the century, and now recently in the sort of Occupy movement. I mean, I was in Athens last year, and they've used the social media, you know, Twitter, Facebook, the internet, YouTube, you know, all these things very successfully to organize the protests, and it has changed the politics of the country. You know, the austerity has been pushed back to a certain extent, and, you know, it looks like the left are going to win the next elections on Sunday. So in that way, I'm not disillusioned. I just think you need to be realistic. It's not... The problem was a lot of people thought that the media was like a substitute for politics, or it was a sort of alternative form of politics, particularly this new left media idea. So in Radio Student, in the 1980s, you didn't have democracy in Slovenia, so it was the media, it was Ladina Radio Student, essentially acted as if they were the parliament. Yeah, but now you have a parliament, or you have, you know, or you have occupied movements or whatever. That's where the real decisions are. The media then becomes a way of those movements communicating with each other and then communicating with the wider citizenship. But I think you just need to be realistic. The media by itself won't change the world. People change the world.
In one of your articles, you state that the main contradiction of modern politics and media remains the need for representation.
Yes. I mean, that's the point. I mean, the new left fantasy was that we could get rid of representation. This goes back to at least Jean-Jacques Rousseau. You know, Rousseau says the only real democracy is 200 men meeting outside their village or 200 artisans meeting in their trade community. And then anything else is, you know, it's alienation. And if you, you know, you can go bring it forward to Guy Debord would say everything, you know, representation is spectacle. It's not actually people doing it for themselves. And this is, there's a lot of truth in that. But the difficulty is, and as people pointed out in the 18th century, what happens when you have countries of millions of people? You know, even a country the size of Slovenia, which is, what, 2 million people? Yeah, I mean, you can't get all 2 million Slovenes onto a field to decide the future of the republic, can you? So even in a, you know, even a country like yours, which is probably the nearest we have to, you know, a Renaissance Italian city-state or an ancient Greek city-state in the world today, you know, even there it's quite difficult to do that, some form of representative democracy. And if you read like someone like Karl Marx, he's very clear on this. I mean, he says what we need is participatory democracy, you know, not direct democracy. We need to check, you know, we're going to have representatives. We have to keep them under close control, make sure they don't earn too much money, and if they go wrong, you can sack them.
Do you think that new technologies proved capable of overcoming this deficit of traditional...
Yes, I mean, that seems to me the great advantage, is you can see what they're doing. I mean, I said, you know, we have to be aware that most people aren't going to be that interested in what their representatives are doing, but occasionally they will be on key issues. And if you could have some greater feedback. But, I mean, you know, there's other things which, again, they suggested in the 17th century, let alone now, which are things like having annual elections for Parliament. That keeps your representatives under control if they face the sack every year. You know, so it's not just the technology. The technology doesn't free us, people. You know, it's relationships between people. I mean, we had this occasion here in 2003 where we had the biggest demonstration in British history. We had 2 million people, which is the population of Slovenia, actually, marching against the Iraq war. The overwhelming majority of the population were against the Iraq war, but we still invaded Iraq. So that's a really good example where democracy isn't functioning properly, it seems to me. And it's like, similarly at the moment, the government, both the parties who have formed the coalition government here, said they weren't going to do any more privatisation on the National Health Service here, and then they promptly did. When you have politicians say one thing to get elected and then, you know, 1 week later doing exactly the opposite once they're elected, this then makes the sort of account, using these technologies to make them more accountable, really important. But as I say, you could do it analog style and just have annual elections. That was what the original suggestion was.
As you already said, the role of the new technologies, communication technologies in popular uprisings in Arab world is obvious. But as we see on the example of Egypt, Twitter and Facebook proved handy tools for toppling a dictator, but are obviously not enough to instate a genuine democratic order.
No, because you have to think the most powerful institution in Egypt after, you know, there's the army that has to, is the mosque. So the mosque, you know, Facebook and Twitter aren't going to replace the mosque very quickly. And there's lots and lots of Gulf Arab money has been poured into building mosques or, and funding people who every Friday tell people what they should think. So it does show that this old-style technology, if to use that, you know, which is the man standing giving the Friday sermon, is more effective, maybe, in reaching the mass of the population. You know, the peasants out in the Egyptian countryside, that's where they're going to get their information from. You can see that by the Salafist vote. The Saudis managed to buy themselves 20% of the electorate. So the mosque is a very, very important organising tool, and the new media aren't going to replace that very quickly. It might well in the next generations, but it's not going to do it now, is it?
You also mentioned that you were working or you are some kind of expert on community media. Where do you see a place for this form of broadcasting in today's world, which seems to be predominated by some big issues such as macroeconomic, financial crisis, transnational associations, and so on?
I mean, the importance of this is getting out the alternative information, isn't it? I mean, you know, as we've seen at the moment, you know, most people go to university where they're, you know, if they get any taught anything about how capitalism works, it's a fantasy. It's a, you know, the stuff your neoclassical economics is basically a lie. And that's what they're taught in. People are taught, my students are taught in a university. They're taught something that's like astrology or something, which masquerading as astronomy. So in that sense, the alternative media has been important in getting out other viewpoints than the sort of, you know, the dominant discourse. As I said, if you watch BBC News, I mean, there's a couple of people. There's a guy called Paul Mason who writes, you know, does some good stuff, but he's mainly talking about the politics of it. But, you know, the actual analysis of the crisis of capitalism, you have to go and log on to David Harvey's website so you can follow his lectures on capital, don't you? You know, I mean, it really is a sort of do-it-yourself thing because you're not going to get it from the institutions. There are a few like lefty academics out there, like I said, like David Harvey, but the, you know, the mainstream economics departments are, you know, they're living in a fantasy land. But I mean, very useful fantasy land for the bankers, but nothing really tell you how really existing capitalism works, does it? So community media, in its widest sense, has got a very important role. It's just, as I said, there's a difference between community media, a very useful tool. I mean, you know, and in a sense, you know, you can see people use Facebook as a community media platform. You know, I mean, even these commercial platforms can be used in that way, let alone, you know, the more obvious avant-garde things, you know, of websites and open source and all this sort of stuff. But I mean, that's important, of getting the information out there, allowing people to communicate, realizing that they're not alone. And the difference between, I think, the 1960s and 1970s fantasy, which is the community media itself was somehow a prototype of the new society. This is sort of like, you know, Felix Guattari, you know, the famous postmodernist philosopher, he actually thought you could get rid of the state and replace it with community radio stations. I thought that was a fantasy in the 1980s, let alone now. Or the internet. I mean, the other obvious thing is the internet then is used as the alternative. And I think that shouldn't be taken seriously. So, you know, there's lots of these much deeper questions, I think, about what we can say. You know, as I said, political censorship is a lot less now than it was 30 years ago. Even economic censorship is less. As I said, you know, you have the weird thing is things like Facebook, for instance. In a way, you could say Facebook is dot-com capitalism serving cybernetic communism, you know, because in a way, okay, they're a very commercial organization, but what they're doing is basically facilitating a gift economy amongst their members. So it, suddenly you've got this worldwide system that allows you to distribute pictures and information. And yes, there is some form of economic censorship there, but much, much less than there used to be. And now, as we say, the last thing is, how, you know, there's 6 billion people on the planet. You can't listen to all of them all the time. You wouldn't have time. I will finish with a quote from Oscar Wilde, who said that the problem with socialism, and this is when it had a positive meaning in the 19th century, was that there wouldn't be time enough for all the meetings. And now we can say maybe there wouldn't be time enough to read all the emails, Facebook postings, YouTubes, tracks that they want you to listen to. There just isn't enough time. So it's the filtering process. And maybe that comes back to what things like Radio Student can do, is it's doing the filtering process for people. It's like a DJ. You know, a really good DJ. I don't have time at 55 to listen to all the dance music records that are released. But if I go to Bass Drive or Sub FM or these other wonderful online stations, they do it for you. Future Frequency, you know, these places, they do it for you. So you have really good DJs and they do the filtering process for you. And that's what I think news, you know, good news is doing. It filters it and packages it for you so you don't have to go out and read all the raw feed. I don't want to read all the WikiLeaks. It would take me far too long and I've got better things to do with my time.
Vprašanja je postavljal Matej Šibenik. Intervju Radija Študent.